Hello and welcome to our podcast, created in partnership with the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society. In this episode, we will be doing a deep dive into the recent $40 billion First Nations Child Welfare Agreements in Principle, discussing questions surrounding the First Nations Child Welfare System, the 15-year-long legal battle preceding the Agreements in Principle, and what this will all mean moving forward. Our guest for this episode is the incredible Dr. Pamela Palmiter. If you follow Indigenous politics in Canada, you have probably already heard Dr. Palmiter's name. She is a professor and the chair in Indigenous governance at Ryerson University, with 4 degrees, including a master's and doctorate in law, and has been a practicing lawyer in good standing with the Law Society of New Brunswick for 23 years. Dr. Palmiter is also an activist and community organizer, having played an important role in the Idle No More movement as a spokesperson, organizer, and public educator for the movement. On top of this, she is a prominent advocate for First Nations peoples and communities who has published several books, had her articles printed in many major Canadian news outlets, been an invited expert on countless media and government panels, and is the host of her very own fantastic podcast, Warrior Life. Without further ado, here is my interview with Dr. Palmiter. Hi, Dr. Palmiter. Thank you so much for joining me today. Could you please start by introducing yourself and telling listeners a little bit about yourself?
For sure, and thanks for having me. Kwe Nindelwizi Pam Palmiter. I am from the Sovereign Mi'kmaq Nation, an unceded Mi'kma'ki, which is on the eastern part of Turtle Island, what's also known as the Maritimes. My home community is Ugwaganjig, and that is often referred to as Eel River Bar First Nation. It's a small First Nation near the top of New Brunswick, and I come from a big, amazing, awesome family.
Thanks. It's nice to meet you. So today on this podcast, we're going to be looking at the $40 billion First Nations Child Welfare Agreements in Principle. But before we get into the details of the agreements, I thought it would be good to just give a quick bit of background on the events that led up to it, and also some context as to why these agreements are necessary in the first place. So what is it about the Canadian child welfare system that led to the legal battle, which eventually culminated in these agreements in principle?
Well, I think for your listeners, it's important to have both the historical context and its connection to the current context, you know, all the headlines that you're seeing in the media. So, the historical context is that ever since contact, settlers and settler governments have had very specific mindset about coming here on our territory. The whole objective was to obtain our lands and resources, and the way in which they did that was to either eliminate us or assimilate us. And one of their other objectives was to reduce any financial costs that they had obtained through treaties or other agreements or obligations. So you can see where this is headed. So the colonial mentality was basically very inherently racist and sexist, in the sense that they never thought that Native people could be in control of themselves, in control of their children, combined with the objective of trying to remove us from our lands. You can see why there would be high rates of apprehensions of our children. So think about the residential school process, where our children were stolen by the thousands and forced into these schools, where many of them were physically and sexually abused and experimented on. And we know from the unmarked graves just how many did not survive these schools. But unfortunately, although residential schools are a part of our history, they never stopped with that mentality that we're not capable of caring for our children, and continued with the 60 scoop forced adoptions, where social workers would go into First Nation communities and take out children by the busloads and forcibly adopt them into white families. And, you know, that didn't stop either, because from those 60 scoop forced adoptions came the foster care crisis. It's so they've kept up with the exact same policy and agenda, which is removing Native people from the lands, removing children from their families. It's just how they did it is what's changed. And so that's what's led to the current foster care crisis. And for anyone who thinks that, you know, residential schools was so substantive in the number of children that went there, well, the current foster care crisis has more than three times the number of children in foster care than during residential schools. So we're not talking about a situation that's getting better. We're talking about a situation that's getting worse. And despite all of the attempts to work with the federal government to end these injustices, these human rights violations, it's been met with frustration and re-traumatization and sadness and anger that the federal government won't stop doing this, or the provincial government, in fact, because provincial governments have a heavy hand in foster care today. So that's why you see human rights tribunal complaints, you see litigation, you see complaints and submissions made to the United Nations human rights treaty bodies, you see advocacy, you see protests, you see public education, because all levels of government have refused to step up and end these injustices. And that kind of brings us to where we are today.
So there's clearly a long history of Canada discriminating against First Nations people and First Nations children. We had the original human rights complaint, which was filed in 2007, that the government was discriminating against First Nations children. And now, bringing it up to the present, we have the agreements in principle that were announced in January of 2022, but that's 15 years. What happened during that 15-year time, and why did it take so long to get to this point?
Well, here's the most important thing to understand about that. Even before you get to the Human Rights Tribunal complaint, there were years of trying to work with federal and provincial governments to stop the apprehensions, to stop the separation of families, to stop these human rights abuses, and we couldn't get any traction. And so you have a phenomenal Gixan warrior, Dr. Cindy Blackstock, who's heading the First Nation Child and Family Caring Society, specifically for the purposes of advocating and getting some form of human rights justice for First Nations children and their families and communities. And although she won the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal complaint, and the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal said, you know, this is racial discrimination. There's no reason for it. The government's own documentation proves that they knew that the purposeful, chronic, discriminatory, racist underfunding of programs and services related to First Nations children led to their disproportionate rates of apprehension, and in fact, increasing rates. Although you would think that would be a victory and the federal government would stop, that didn't happen. And so the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal had to keep issuing non-compliance orders over and over and over and over again. And so literally years of Dr. Cindy Blackstock, non-stop with her team who's been working on this pro bono, with children advocating, with human rights advocates. I mean, they even traveled, a small contingency of children even traveled with her to the United Nations to make this case. Courtrooms often filled with children, classrooms watching this over and over and over again, where you have federal officials just refusing to end the injustice. We were quite concerned about where this was headed. So you have a separate group who decided to file a class action. And just after all of these things were getting worse, you had the revelation of the unmarked graves of tiny children and babies who were at residential schools. And it wasn't just in one community. Then it was in another. Then it was hundreds more in another, and hundreds more in another. And you could literally feel the anger and outrage in Canadians all across the country demanding that the government address this issue, but also the advocacy of residential school survivors and the families of children who didn't survive, saying, not only do you have to address these historic abuses and stop litigating against residential school survivors, also have to end the legacy of residential schools, which is ongoing child apprehensions in foster care. All of these children in unmarked graves, you've got the residential school survivors, you've got Dr. Cindy Blackstock bringing all of this attention to the Canadian public, and they just said enough is enough. And I think it was that outrage that forced Canada's hand to the table, because how could they justify that they respect and support First Nation kids in care and they respect human rights and residential school survivors, while we could all watch court on live TV where they didn't support them and where they denied responsibility and actually tried to portray themselves as the victims.
Right. And so in the end, I guess the government was essentially forced to take action here. Now we have this action, and we know that the agreement in principle has been reached in large part thanks to the advocacy of First Nations organizations, including the tireless work of Dr. Cindy Blackstock. So we have some details, but can you fill us in on what actually is known about these agreements in principle?
Right. So we've got this agreement in principle, and keep in mind, they're not legally binding. They're a statement of intentions about what all parties decide to do. And we got to that place because the federal court was appealing the compensation that was ordered for First Nation kids, and both First Nations and the Canadian public said, no, that's not going to cut it. So they were really forced at the end to have these fast negotiations over the holidays to come to some sort of agreement. And so you have the parties being the federal government, obviously, the First Nation Child and Family Services, who are representing all of the First Nations children and families who are part of the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal decisions. You have the Assembly of First Nations, and then you have the lawyers representing those in the class action group. And the idea was to bring all of these issues together under one agreement and settle it all together. So you've got roughly $20 billion for kids on reserve who were unnecessarily removed from their homes and families. And the compensation is intended to go to the First Nations children, but also to parents and caregivers, because there's a significant amount of damage and trauma that's inflicted, especially on moms, when their children are forcibly taken away. It's also intended to compensate children who were not entitled or denied benefits under what's known as Jordan's principle, where First Nations children should be able to access health services and other kind of supportive programs without discrimination or having to wait for a jurisdictional battle between federal and provincial governments. So any of those people who were denied Jordan's principle benefits, it's intended to also give them some kind of compensation. Now, the other part of the agreement is another $20 billion, but that's intended to reform the whole First Nation child welfare system. It's intended to help things like First Nations children who age out of foster care and then are left to their own devices. It's intended to support them, because them being in foster care and disadvantage is not their fault. It's also a significant focus, and what we have been really advocating for is on prevention and family support, so that you don't have children in foster care that you need to support, but to stop them from going into foster care, to try to keep families and children together, have all of the same programs and services that Canadian children are able to take for granted. So that's generally what that is supposed to take care of. We've yet to see how that's going to unravel, but we'll see what happens.
That was really illuminating on
especially the difference between the $20 billion for compensation and the $20 billion for structural reforms is an important difference. In a lecture you gave on truth and reconciliation at the University of Regina, you make it clear that reconciliation, as the Canadian government currently understands and practices it to the extent that it does, is more about self-congratulation than much else. Do these agreements in principle represent a divergence from that pattern or not? And how do you see them fitting into the process of reconciliation, if at all?
Reconciliation, as I understand it, is where you are intentional and purposeful about doing several things: ending ongoing injustices, making reparations for past injustices, not only apologizing, but making sure that you never do these kind of abuses again in the future. And the public education part around where you take responsibility for what you've done. This is supposed to be done on a proactive basis. Can you really call it reconciliation if you're forced to apologize because a court tells you you have to? Is it really reconciliation if First Nations people have to fight for decades to get justice and spend their time, their energy, their money, their resources to try to force the government to come to the table to negotiate some sense of justice? I would say that's not reconciliation. I would say that we are in a situation where the federal government was absolutely forced to the table with almost no real political options, moral options, or legal options. I mean, you cannot pass the Bill C-15, which promotes the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, and then turn around and continue to appeal every court case and not comply with the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal. You simply can't do that. Am I happy about the agreement in principle? Yes, it looks like residential school survivors, families, foster care children, communities, human rights advocates, and all of these people have come together to force the government to the table. Was it voluntary? No. Was it preemptive or well-intended? No. And you know what I would like to see? I would like to see every single person that's ever been involved in this advocacy be acknowledged for all of the time and effort they put into it, and for the government to accept that responsibility wholeheartedly and admit that this is just one of the ways in which they have and continue to engage in genocide against Indigenous peoples. And that's an important part of this, because you can't say it was well-intended, but oops, this policy just went wrong. It was never well-intended. It was always meant to destroy families, destroy culture. And that is a part of genocide. And you have to have intention for that. You know, Canada, if they want to call this an act of reconciliation, they've got to do all of the other parts around it and stop being forced to the table through litigation and outrage by Canadians.
So another thing that kind of comes to mind as we're talking about all of this is that, you know, we talk about the legal proceedings and the technical details of these agreements and the compensation. It feels as though there is still a bit of a human dimension missing. In your interviews with Cindy Blackstock on your Warrior Life podcast, it's very clear. There's a real human cost to all of this. And how do you think that the government can acknowledge this in a way that goes beyond compensation or structural reform?
That's a really good question. And Cindy and I talk about these things all the time. She has been phenomenal about making sure that the kids are at the forefront, that the focus is on the kids and the well-being of the families and what the impacts are. So I think it's important for listeners to understand that just the theft of these children, the apprehension of these children, that is devastating in and of itself. But think of the millions of nights away from home that these children spent scared, confused, angry, traumatized, not getting the help or supports that they need, all because of racism. And then many of them, as soon as they turn 18, they're left to the streets. What Canadians need to understand is that there is some very stark realities to that, that statistically we know First Nations children in foster care are far less likely to get a high school education than Canadian children. They're far more likely to be subjected to physical abuse or sexual abuse. And we also know that more than 80% of all situations where First Nations children are forced into foster care, those situations break down by the age of 16. These are devastating situations. So it's not like the common misunderstanding. We didn't take kids from a bad scenario and put them into a good one. We put them out of an Indigenous context and put them into a terrible scenario. Some foster care situations are great, but the statistics are dire. We have to understand this from a kid's perspective, from a family perspective, and what it does to communities. I mean, the loss of language and culture, the loss of cultural awareness. Sometimes ties with families are permanently devastated. Some of these children are exploited and abused and end up being in the missing and murdered Indigenous girls category. So this is all very serious stuff that we need to do. And what I like most about what Cindy Blackstock did in the humanizing part of it is she involved kids in this, you know, not just First Nation kids, but Canadian kids, to help them send the message to Canada, the government, and the world that this isn't right. And even a small child knows right from wrong. And even a small child knows, hey, I wouldn't want to be taken away from my family. Or that's not fair that First Nation kids don't have clean water to drink. And I think having addressed this issue from that perspective is what has made all of this successful, because it means it's not someone doing something. It's working together in partnership where children and families have agency in this. They're a part of what's happening moving forward. I can't commend them enough. I'm inspired every day by the things that Cindy has done.
I wanted to ask about the process for the agreements in principle moving forward. So we know that the parties involved in the negotiations will continue to work towards a finalized agreement, which, according to the government, will unfold throughout 2022. And what are some possible issues or pitfalls that we might have to look out for as the agreements in principle move forward?
Well, we know at this stage that the agreement in principle is not legally binding and that it still has to be approved by both the federal court and the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal. So I think it's important for Canadians to understand it's not over, because oftentimes there's a pattern where the government announces an initiative or some funding or an agreement in principle, an MOU, and then people say, oh, thank goodness, you know, that's resolved. And I don't even have to think about that again. We need to keep this front and center on a ongoing basis, go forward basis. We need to look at whether there's any delays in the process to either issuing the compensation or the infrastructure part. We need to look very carefully at whether the federal government will have a paternalistic, detailed control over the whole process. and not be a process that's jointly developed by the people that are involved in it. I think we should always keep an eye out for insufficient budgeting, unspent budgets, because the federal government, especially in Indigenous affairs, is famous for making announcements, but then they turn back money to the Treasury Board every year, and sometimes almost $1 billion. We have to make sure that the application process isn't so overwhelming and so detailed that it becomes a burden and a challenge to the people who need the compensation. And I hate to say this because I'm a lawyer, but one of the things we've seen is that we also have to watch for unethical lawyers and unethical law firms, because there has been some reports of exploitation and unethical activity for those things, and there has had to be some interventions. So it's by far and wide, that's not all lawyers. But because there seems to be some issues around unethical lawyering and law firms when it comes to anything Indigenous, especially where it's compensation, we need to keep an eye out for that and make sure there's protections that are built in. I'm also concerned about potential future litigation. So if things break down on the part of the federal government and they resort back to litigation or telling everyone that they have to start over. But I'm just going from past experience. This is like something that happens with the federal government. I guess finally, what I'm looking for is the details about the second part, the $20 billion that are supposed to roll out over the next 5 years. What's it going to go to? Who has control over that money? Just how it's going to help people and not just end up being another list of federal programs, initiatives that are underfunded, ineffective, and not what First Nations children and family want. I'm looking for all of that. I'm hopeful because Cindy's there, the kids are there, the families are there, but I am also very weary from past experience about what's happened.
Fair enough. There's definitely a lot to watch out for, and I'm sure that all of us will have our eyes on that as these agreements in principle move forward. So if we take a look beyond the scope of the agreements in principle, because we know that this is just going to be the start for improving conditions for First Nations children, what are some issues relating to First Nations child welfare or Indigenous rights in general, where action needs to be taken to make a step forward?
Well, they need to stop dealing with this on a one-off basis, only responding when Canadians get outraged. They need to take a step back and say, wait a second, we had the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which had all of these calls to action for all of us to deal with things like unmarked graves. And look at all the years that went by and there was not even a mention of unmarked graves. It's not until they are shown to the public gets outraged, and then they're forced to take action. That's not reconciliation. Also about causing physical and mental trauma and injury to Indigenous peoples with the intention to destroy them. It's also about creating the conditions of life intended to cause this injury and destruction of their communities. Canada only needed to be found guilty of one of those things. And I say only very respectfully, because any one of those are devastating. We need to look at genocide as the national human rights crisis that it is, and that neither the federal government nor the provincial governments have done that. We need to stop violence against Indigenous women and girls. We need to stop child apprehensions. We need to stop the growing incarceration rate. We need to stop human trafficking. We need to stop the forced and coerced sterilizations that happened historically and continue to happen, because there's class action for that now. We need to stop the institutionalization of Indigenous peoples, the forced removals from our lands, And we need to stop excluding First Nation women and children from their communities through sex and race-based discrimination in the Indian Act and denying them band membership and connection with their community. We need to do basic human rights. So you can see how long it's going to take to address injustice if we just go litigation by litigation by litigation, because look at how long it took us to get to the agreement and principle stage on child and family services, just for First Nations kids on reserve. So we need to look at it all together and have a national plan to address all of these things. And it's got to be based in a human rights framework.
This is all really important. And it brings to mind a question for me, which is maybe a very big question to throw at you, but do you see this changing? And if so, what would have to change in the government, perhaps in society in general, for this kind of good faith relationship to actually come to fruition?
Well, I have a great deal of faith in First Nations. I have a great deal of faith in all of our First Nation advocates, our First Nations women and families and communities, our nations. I mean, they're just tireless, and they never give up. Imagine, First Nations people, it's always First Nations people. I mean, look at what happened with Idle No More. And so the thing that gives me also a lot of hope is that since Idle No More, Canadians have taken up the call to self-educate and to take action. So we've moved away from just general awareness. I mean, because awareness doesn't accomplish anything. You need to know what's happening so you can take action, and not just once, but on an ongoing basis. So for however long Canadians live on Indigenous territories, benefit from Indigenous territories and see injustice, they need to be engaging, pushing governments to change and changing themselves. So although it would be nice to just have one particular area to push and to blame, oh, it's just the government. It's all of us. We all have an obligation to deal with this. And what really gives me hope is that I see more and more and more Canadians standing up to challenge their own institutions, governing institutions, but also their own places of work and their own communities and societies. And so I think this union between First Nations and Canadians, that's what gives me hope. And that's really the real governing body. It's the people who are the government. Those people who are elected are just there to implement what we tell them to implement. So I think that's what we're going to see a change in the future.
Thanks a lot. And I think that's a very hopeful and positive note to end our interview on. So that concludes our interview for today. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you so much for having me and for covering this incredibly important issue, because the more you know, the more ways you can take action.
Thank you so much for listening. If you want to hear more from Dr. Palmiter, you can find her website at pampalmiter.com. That's pampalmiter.com. I would highly recommend that you check out her Warrior Life podcast, where she dives into a wide range of topics relating to decolonization and Indigenous resurgence, and interviews some really interesting people, including the interviews with Dr. Cindy Blackstock that we mention in this episode. She also has a podcast called Warrior Kids that celebrates Indigenous culture and aims to help educate and inspire children and families to be warriors for social and environmental justice. You can find both of these podcasts on SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Today's episode was also made possible thanks to a collaboration with the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society. We encourage you to go check out their website at fncaringsociety.com, where you can learn more about what they do and also support the organization itself. They also have a ton of educational resources for adults and kids alike. Thanks again for listening, and like Dr. Palmiter said, the more you know, the more you can take action. So stay curious and keep learning.